This is an FCIC interview with Dr. Madeline Antoncic, A-N-T-O-N-C-I-C, of Lehman Brothers, July 14th, 2010. An FCIC of Christopher, Troy Burris, Joey Dengen, and Tom Stanton, and Sarah Knauss.
And Dr. Antoncic is here, and also Derek Chan, who is an associate in our office.
All right, we have... I'll just let everybody introduce themselves that are here.
Sure. My name's Chris Seifer. I'm with the FCIC.
I think it's me.
Joby Dungannon, also with FCIC.
Tom Stanton. We're all with the FCIC.
Sarah Knauss, FCIC.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear your name.
Sarah. It was Sarah Knauss.
So Troy, Chris, Joe, Tom, and Sarah.
That's correct.
So Troy, I'm sorry, Chris and Joe, I did not get your last name.
Chris's last name is Seifer, S-E-E-F-E-R.
And Joe?
Joby. My last name's Dungannon, D-A-N-G-A-N-A-N.
I'm sorry, can you spell that one more time?
D as in David, A-N-G-A-N-A-N.
And Troy?
It's a B-U-R-R-U-S.
Okay.
Excellent. Well, I just wanted to thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us today, taking time out of your schedule to do this. Like I spoke with Mr. Wool, we're going to have some general questions. Hopefully he's kind of giving you that topic area that we're interested in. Tom Stanton is going to ask some questions more along the lines of risk management, corporate governance type issues that he's got a few questions on that you may be able to help him with. And then ours are basically going to be, like I talked with Mr. Wool about, your experiences at Lehman prior to the Bear Stearns near collapse up into the Lehman bankruptcy. But first of all, I'd like to kind of get an idea of your career at Lehman, most specifically when you started there and the different positions that you held there, and then when your last day was there.
Okay.
Okay,
just to put things in a little bit of context, I'll give you a backup a little bit even from Lehman and give you a little bit of my background, and then I can swing into Lehman.
Okay.
So I've got a PhD in economics and finance. I was at the Fed as an economist first for a couple of years. Got recruited to Goldman Sachs and to start up there, or to sort of continue in the evolution of their market risk practice, market risk management. I oversaw that on a global basis when Bob Rubin and Steve Freeman became co-chief operating officers and then into their co-vice chairmanship. They asked me to be their special assistant, which I did, as I continued to oversee risk. By the late 80s, I really wanted to trade, so by January of 90, I switched into trading, and I traded for through mid-97 on the mortgage trading desk. And in particular, most of my time was spent trading the so-called private label CMOs, so the non-agency CMOs, first secondary trading and then new issue and secondary trading. And then I went to Barclays Capital for 2 years, and I was the America's head of risk, a market risk. And then they also asked me to be the treasurer for Barclays PLC as well as Barclays Capital. And I was also on the I forget what they call it. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Some committee of their, you know, their executive committee at Barclays. And then in 99, July of 99, went to Lehman. I first went to Lehman to as the head of risk policy. And my first assignment was to establish and set up a risk framework, risk equity, risk appetite framework, which I did. And then, I don't remember exactly the timing, but I was asked on a shortly thereafter basis, I think before the year end in 99, to be a global head of market risk. And then in September of 02, was asked to take on the chief risk officer role. And then did that through sort of unofficially mid-07, and officially announced the end of 07, September of 07, and at which point I became responsible for policy relations. So between September of 07 and the bankruptcy, September of 08, I had nothing to do with anything internally, not risk or anything else, quite frankly. My whole focus was externally focused on policy questions, regulatory kind of policy questions, and engaging with the policymakers. And then in October of 08, I joined the Lehman estate to help in the unwind of the derivative portfolios, and also working on the J.P. Morgan side of this whole bankruptcy. And I left that assignment last the end of October of 09.
Okay. Okay, that's good information. Let me ask you, so you were there, okay, so you were Lehman from basically July of 99 through 2009?
Correct.
Okay, so in your...
We were October of 2009.
Right, October 2009. So let me get a sense from you. What was your exposure? What was your experiences dealing with counterparties that were Lehman counterparties, and what was your sense of what was going on with those counterparties before the Bear Stearns collapse?
I was responsible for counterparty risk, among other things, as the chief risk officer. But if you recall, Bear Stearns collapsed March 13th of 08, or that weekend, and I was long gone from risk management, so I would not have any idea about any relationships, counterparty relationships, just prior to that.
Okay, so, but when you, before that, let's go back further. When you were the chief risk officer, how was the relationship with counterparties at Lehman? Was there a strong relationship? Did you have a lot of business with various counterparties? Was it a strong, thriving business, or was it cyclical, up and down?
And if I can you first just generally describe how you managed counterparty risk?
Okay, well, yes, I'll do that in a second. But when you say was our relationship strong, we had many, 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 many counterparties, right? And we had many types of counterparties. And it's not as if it's a quote, business. It's just part of... It's an outcome. So it's part of doing business. By definition, you'll have counterparties. So it's not as if counterparties, having a counterparty is a, quote, business. It's just part of the ordinary course of business, doing other stuff. You end up having a counterparty.
Right. So maybe you could describe generally first how you managed counterparty risk. And I noticed when you gave the introduction to your background, you said, I think the last thing you were doing there was managing the J.P. Morgan side of the bankruptcy, which I'm assuming means that $8.6 billion they called on the company towards the end. So maybe you can sort of, you know, use that as an example of how Bear managed counterparty exposure.
Lehman.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
Bear.
Yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, I was not, quote, managing the relationship of the JPM. What I was doing was advising the A&M and people that were unwinding the estate on looking at, you know, here was our exposure, how do we value that, what should the valuation have been at the time of bankruptcy as opposed to what their claim was. That's the kind of thing I was working on.
Okay.
So I can just tell you how we managed counterparty. Let me just back up and tell you the types of counterparties that we would have. So we had obviously many kinds of counterparties. right? We would have corporations that want to do swaps. They want to do fixed to floating interest rate swap when you issue when they issue debt. So that's one type of counterparty. We would have hedge funds as counterparties. And again, these are all because they want to do some kind of derivative trade. So that's how they end up being a counterparty. Or we would have sovereigns as counterparties, municipalities. So these are the different types of counterparties that we would have, and there's many others. The way we would manage counterparty risk is first do the diligence in terms of deciding whether or not we want to be engaged with a particular counterpart. So if a salesperson comes or a trader comes and says, okay, we want to do business with XYZ company or XYZ guy, we would do our due diligence to decide whether or not we want to, based on a whole bunch of factors, not just about their creditworthiness, first and foremost their reputation and the kind of organization it is. And then we would look at all of the credit related kinds of things that you want to see. And then we would set a limit in terms of how much exposure we would want to any particular counterpart, depending on the so many counterparts to many types of different transactions. And so based on the transaction, we would decide, or on the transaction types, we would decide what kind of margin requirements we would require. So depending on the trade, depending on the counterpart, we would also give internal ratings, credit ratings for the counterparts. And then depending on the type of transactions and also the types of collateral that the counterpart was transacting in, we would determine how much margin requirement initially we would have. And then for most counterparts, and the reason I say most is because typically corporations don't do daily mark-to-market, but for most counterparts, then we would have daily mark-to-market and margin calls. And so we would be responsible for making sure that we would have the appropriate kinds of margin. And then, of course, on a regular basis, continue to follow the every counterpart to make sure that, you know, the creditworthiness is consistent with what our initial analyses were.
So
we would have people that would go out into the field and go out and visit clients and visit counterparts and so on.
If I can ask, because it sounds like a Goldman-type approach with the daily mark-to-market and margin calls, is that where you learned that approach to dealing with counterparties?
No, I didn't do counterparty risk at Goldman, and that's not a quote Goldman type of approach. That's the ordinary course of business.
Okay.
I'm sure you've heard of ISDA by now in your inquiry.
Yep.
And just like the exchanges, right? The future exchange. That's mm-hmm. just the way the business is done. Now the futures exchanges have a set margin. But when you're things that are off the exchange and different dealers or banks, they can have their own different margin requirements, and depending on their comfort level of risk and their comfort level of counterparts. I was pretty strict in terms of our exposures. Strict as in wanting to have, you know, minimal exposure. So our risk tolerance was not high, and so we would have, you know, strict initial margin requirements. So the guy wants to do a trade, we say he has to put up X amount. And then on a daily basis, always have mark-to-market. So the mark-to-market margin calls are not a margin requirement as in a percentage, that we say we want versus somebody else may want. The initial margin call is what's going to be different. The mark-to-market is just a regular, it is what it is.
Was there any, what about it? Those examples you gave, unless I'm missing something, didn't seem to be covering the funding side of the balance sheet. What about the folks that you guys, you know, were borrowing money from? You know, whether it was the repo counterparties or you know, those kinds of folks. How did you?
That's the same thing, because that is all part of the same. So when you have a counterparty, that is part of the funding, at least on the repo side, putting aside treasury funding, because a counterparty. On a mark-to-market basis, they could owe me money or I could owe them money, right? And by definition, when I owe them money, obviously that's the lending part, right? Mm-hmm. But daily, on a daily basis, it goes, you know, it can go up and down.
Okay. Were you involved at all? I mean, one of the things we've seen in the documents and in the Veloukis report, for example, is the whole tri-party clearing relationship with the cities and the J.P. Morgans of the world, and the fact that towards the end, you know, J.P. Morgan made that $8.5 billion call that, you know, didn't help things out any for Lehman. Were you involved in managing those types of exposures? Not at that time. I mean, not in the 08. I know you weren't chief risk officer then, but in the pre... in the, you know, 2002 to mid-2007 time frame?
Ask that question again, because I think I don't want to confuse. The Treasury Department would manage those relationships. So they were, as I understand it, and I believe that is true. So the Treasury, people in Treasury manage the relationships with our tri-party agents, for example. And so that I'm not involved in, except to the extent that when any relationship manager asked me to, you know, just as the chief risk officer, if some other counterpart wanted to come in to talk to us because they also want to check, you know, kick the tires on us, I would obviously speak with these counterparts. But I wasn't involved in, quote, managing that relationship. But the aspect, so there's many parts to this. So the aspect of the money going in, money going out, that's the operational side. There's the management of the relationship side. Both of those are away from me, but then there is the initial, do we want to do business with this guy or not? That's part, that's my responsibility. And how much exposure do we want to have to this guy? That's my responsibility.
So does that mean that before, and I don't know when J.P. Morgan became a clearing agent for Lehman, but would Lehman have looked at that and done due diligence, as you described before, before they would have said, okay, we're going to use Lehman as our clearing agent? I'm sorry, I keep misspeaking, don't I? Before we're going to use J.P. Morgan as our clearing agent?
Well, that's not a good example because, A, they were our clearing agent to begin with. B, the reason that's not a good to begin with, meaning before I ever showed up on the scene of Lehman Brothers, B, it's not a good example because what you should understand is JPM was sort of almost a monopoly, maybe at best an oligopoly because there's JPM and there's Boney.
Right.
So that's not something that I would say, yeah, you know what, I don't want to deal with JPM because guess what, then you don't have any, you know, nobody to clear. So that's not a good example of the kind of things that we would look at.
Okay.
Because that part of JPM is a utility for the entire financial system, frankly.
Right. And what I'm just trying to get at is, since we do know that they made that $8.5 billion call, I'm trying to understand how Lehman managed that risk. So any, you know, insight you can provide on that, understanding that you said that was the Treasury Department, not the risk department, but if you have any insight on that, that would be helpful.
Well, though, that is not the same as the counterparty mark-to-market margin call.
I understand.
Okay, so what that was saying, they're looking and they're saying, okay, we think our intraday risk may be getting higher, because we think the volatility is getting higher, and therefore we would like more money to cover that. That was what that was about. As opposed to saying, okay, we had a particular transaction. Now, to the extent that they had the derivatives at the end, only through my working at the estate, not you know, concurrently with the events, because I was out of risk at the time, but having looked at it after the fact, when I was working for the estate, as I saw the numbers, it appeared, and I don't recall exactly the numbers, but we had about $1 billion, maybe $1.1 billion, of mark-to-market exposure that they owed us. And so JPM owed us, and that was on the derivative portfolio. And part of that margin, part of that request for additional collateral at the end was saying, okay, the mark to market we think is going to swing the other way, and so the mark to market part would be the part that would be under the responsibility of risk management. And basically, just as a practical matter, the way things work is every day, if it's Goldman Sachs or anybody else making a margin call, they are what they call margin disputes. And so if one investment bank is making a call on another bank or any counterpart, and all of a sudden it's a big margin call, the other counterpart has the right through ISDA to say, hang on, we don't agree with that, we're not making that call, And then typically you have three different, you can go to three different outside sources to figure out, okay, what do you think the mark-to-market is, and then decide on how to handle that dispute.
Right, you have a dealer poll under the terms of the ISDA contract. But again, there you're talking about a mark-to-market based margin call, for example, on a derivative contract. And I get that, and we just had fun with Goldman and AIG on that. But what I'm trying to get a better hold of, and you know, you may just not be the person to talk to, is this whole issue that happened with J.P. Morgan. And I've seen the complaint that the estate filed, where you know the allegation is in there that about the $1.1 billion exposure the other way in Lehman's favor on the derivative position. But before we get to that, I want to get an understanding of what Lehman was doing about managing the potential intraday risk, you know, that could result from, as you mentioned, increased volatility or whatever, and that, as we now know, rightly or wrongly, resulted in Lehman posting $8.5 billion in that first and second week of September.
Okay, so are you asking me what we were doing to manage our intraday risk, or what they were trying to do to manage what they perceived to be our intraday risk?
Well, I guess both, but in the first instance, I'm more interested in generally what Lehman was doing to manage it.
I don't know what Lehman was doing because, again, I was not involved.
Okay.
But I can shed a little bit of light, I think, on what the intent or what JPM claimed the intent was, because I was involved in the estate, you know, working on that aspect. And so all I know was that during that time frame, mid-August through mid-September. Frankly, as I understood the argument, Bear Stearns kind of heightened the sensitivity level of JPM as a clearing agent, saying, you know what, maybe we have more exposure on an intraday basis as a clearing agent than we may have thought. So they presumably or supposedly were going and looking through various, you know, exposures that they had. Mid-August, apparently, there were conversations back and forth between Lehman and JPM. And what they were thinking was that as a tri-party clearing agent, intraday, our exposure based on volatility, we think, is going to be higher. And Lehman was arguing that, no, we think you already have enough collateral. And so apparently, Lehman did post some more. And apparently, Lehman did some kind of an analysis that, and again, this is all information that I've learned subsequent to the bankruptcy working on the estate, that Lehman said we had some kind of analysis that they did to show that they thought that a JPM was more than covered, and but JPM sort of just continued to press it, thinking that they had further needs.
I don't think I've seen the internal Lehman analysis, but I have at least seen in the complaint that, you know, there was a new series of agreements entered into in August of 08. Do you have any knowledge about the circumstances that led to that?
Yeah, August and September of 08.
Oh, right, yeah, and then there's another set of agreements in September of 08, right.
Yeah, now I can't remember all the details because it's already, you know, a while since I've looked at that stuff, but that was just for them to just really solidify what today, meaning JPM, their interest was to solidify their position. And so they got various agreements, not the least of which making holdings guarantee every subsidiary, and including having holdings at the end, actually the last day, having holdings, I think it was the 10th, which was the earnings call day, I believe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then bankruptcy was the Friday was the 12th. That morning, prior to the earnings call, they actually, all night before, and finally signed that morning, like at 6:30 in the morning or whatever, they even included derivative transactions to have the, usually derivatives, as you know, are pari passu with anybody else, and they threw that in and as part of their guarantee to go jump, in other words, jumping ahead of everybody else.
Did Lehman also use Boney as a tri-party clearing agent?
As far as I understand, yes, but I couldn't tell you for which assets. But I can tell you that JPM was our biggest bank as a bank.
Right.
So JPM had a lot of hats on, right? So JPM was a bank. JPM was also a counterpart doing trades with us. So it should be, you know, sort of the separation and, you know, of different functions. And then, of course, JPM was also the tri-party clearing agent.
Did Boney?
They were our biggest bank as a bank. And that's why there was that lunch prior to that week of the earnings call where the treasurer and others, the head of risk, shared with them all of the information, trying to be very open with them in terms of the earnings, and they were going to be less than what they had expected. And then, of course, that's one of the triggers that made JPM come back even more, you know, vigorously to ask for more collateral.
Right. Did Boney ever come and ask for more?
I don't recall. I know that several banks did ask for collateral. Citi, B of A, Macquarie. I believe Boney, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
But that was all along the end. And again, this is all from my looking at one as working for the estate. But, you know, sort of as rumors start to appear, that's what typically happens.
Okay. Let me go to another topic, if I can, and get your general take on this. And that is, you know, one of the things we've also noticed is that Lehman, you know, ended up writing down their commercial real estate and the residential real estate positions. What was the general, from a chief risk officer, risk management perspective, how did Lehman go about managing its exposures to those types of securities?
I can't speak for the last year, but I can tell you that prior to my departure, every business was under a very strict regime of having limits, both risk appetite limits, cash capital limits, balance sheet limits. Risk appetite limits were what I was responsible for, and the way we would look at real estate in particular was looking at various aspects and stress test kind of analyses, and using historical data back through the early 90s, late 80s, when we had that whole meltdown in the real estate. And so we had a very rigorous approach to measuring the potential exposure and risk for our for all of our assets, and in real estate in particular, because that was obviously a very you know, sort of the chunky positions, and so you had a lot of tail risk in those kinds of positions, and so those were managed the way we did all of our other businesses, different analytics, obviously, because of a different asset class.
Were the limits in writing? Were there policies that said,
yes.
Okay, were those limits, when you were there, complied with?
I can't tell you on a day-to-day basis, obviously, from a recollection, and I can just you know, refer you to the examiner's report, because he's got circumstances where they were and where they weren't.
Okay, while I haven't read the entire 2,200-page report,
it's very well written, actually.
It's on my list, but I hope to get to it before the end of this weekend. Let me ask you this, and I think this may also be in the report: were the policy limits changed and increased to accommodate a desire to take on more exposure?
On a firm-wide level, the limits were annually they were reviewed, and that was part of the policy, to review them, to go up or down.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there were times when it went down, and notably after 2002, I remember. And then also on a quarterly basis, the limits were reviewed. In March of 06, you can read the examiner's report. I believe that's when it was. There was a conference that we had down in Florida, and where, you know, senior members of the firm were business people, and, you know, all the senior members of the firm, and there was a decision to somewhat increase the risk profile of the firm, and that was a decision at the executive committee level, and that went to the board, and the board approved it, and so there was a concerted effort to increase the risk profile, and that's when risk limits were increased.
Were you consulted on that decision?
I was part of the whole process, yes.
And did you agree with that decision? Did you agree with that decision, and were there people that were taking the contrary view of, no, we shouldn't increase our exposure to real estate?
No, I never said it was to increase our exposure to real estate. I said it was the decision was to increase our risk profile generally. There was no, I don't recall any specific, certainly at the 06 time frame. So everything I just said did not refer to real estate, but it was in general, because I took your question to be general, were limits increased.
Okay. And so when you say the decision was made to increase the risk profile generally, what does that mean, generally?
That means that the belief of the firm, the executive committee, the board, was that in order to have the highest returns for our shareholders, we were not deploying our capital in the most efficient way possible. And the belief was we should, as a responsibility to the shareholders, increase the return. And by the way we would do that would be to increase the risk.
Okay, so...
If you have capital just sitting idly, that's not a good use of capital. Obviously, the balance has to be using enough of your capital, i.e. taking enough risk, to maximize your return, while not taking too much risk to then, you know, lose money and then impair that return. So obviously, there's a fine line and there's a balance to be making, and that's the whole, you know, risk-reward thing that everybody strives for.
Right. So did increasing the risk profile mean, one, increasing leverage, and two, investing funds, whether it's capital or financing, into higher yielding assets?
I'm not sure I would use the word investing into higher yielding assets. Keep in mind, we're not Lehman was a broker dealer and investment bank. And you don't, quote, invest in stuff. And I'm saying that with a little caution, because we did start, quote, investing, but that's not really sort of what was going to drive our whole business. We did start investing somewhat in hedge funds. But that's not what we mean by increasing our risk. But I wouldn't use the word investing, because that suggests a buy and hold kind of thing.
Okay.
Where as an investment bank, that's not what you do. You don't, quote, invest. But
okay.
Again, the reason I'm being very particular here is because we did, quote, invest, but that was a very small part of our whole balance sheet.
Right. So why don't you then describe to me what the company did do to increase its risk profile?
Just take on... So, for example, go back to our counterparts. One way that you can take on more risk is to say, well, you know, and I'm just going to use this as an example.
Sure.
I think, you know, this treasury that I'm funding... I would used to use, you know, ask for 5% margin, but maybe, you know, that's probably too much, you know, and we're really being a little too conservative. Maybe it's 2% margin. And now by definition, I've just increased my risk. So it's those kinds of things, and it's incremental, right? So I can't say, well, we did X, because you did X across the board on a, you know, an international global company, very complex, with lots of businesses. So for every business, you can think in terms of, okay, well, are we being a little bit too conservative, or should we, you know, push out a little bit on the risk profile? So real estate, you know, should we do more deals, you know, high yield? Should we do more deals? Should we be a little bit more aggressive in trying to bid on these transactions? Before, we were very conservative and not really, you know, winning that many mandates. Maybe we should be a little bit less conservative and more competitive, and try to win more mandates. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And that's in general, you know, but again, it's across the board.
Sure. So let me ask you some questions specifically to real estate, and let me tell you where I'm coming from. When we look at the 08 results, you know, we do see, you know, for the year-to-date numbers through the third quarter, you've got about, you know, that $8 billion of... unrealized or realized losses in the capital market segment that I believe is primarily the residential real estate positions and the commercial real estate positions and some asset-backed stuff. So was there in the March 06 time frame or subsequent to that, a decision to take on more exposure in the real estate area?
I don't know in particular. I suspect the answer is yes, because in general we were taking on risk, more risk, functionally across the board.
We've seen some, I think we've seen some, since I haven't read the entire report, but some mentions in the Veloukis report about folks internally saying, we think we have too much exposure to real estate.
At one point, that's correct.
Okay. Can you provide any color on that in terms of what your views were, and regardless of what your views were, what you were hearing and the timing?
Yeah. Well, so for example, the view was that we were maybe having too much concentration in certain kinds of asset types within real estate. So land, for example, I was concerned about. What happens is, as within the leveraged lending space, all of a sudden, because of externalities, right? Because all of a sudden, externally, sponsors, i.e., private equity firms, for example, want to do transactions because there's so much liquidity in the system. They're all coming, knocking on our respective doors all at the same time. And so, basically, what happens is it's sort of incoming phone calls, as it were. And all of your clients are coming to you saying, can we do this, can we do that? And my concern was, while any one particular transaction might look good, when you sort of keep saying yes to all of your best friends, then you start getting too much, right? So it's really sort of the externalities are saying, okay, you're great at real estate, which we were very good at, and, we were kind of improving our game in the leveraged lending space, and that's really where we increased our risk, I would say, disproportionately. Based on our historical and our track record. And so when everybody is coming and asking you to do things and you're accommodating your clients, then all of a sudden things start to add up. And that's really sort of the gist of what happened. Now, so for example, specifically in real estate, starting to get a lot of German deals because everybody on the outside were, buying German assets and then wanting us to fund German properties. And so that was one of my concerns, the German deals. We were getting a lot of exposure there. Or, as I said, the land deals.
So, I want to make sure I understand. Are you saying essentially Lehman acting as a market maker, the clients were wanting to take positions that required Lehman to build inventory in these areas?
Yep. But I wouldn't use the word, and I'm being very technical, I wouldn't use the word market maker in this context. A market maker is really more in a liquid asset kind of space, so stock bonds. Trading. Real estate was, you have clients, you have BlackRock, you have Blackstone, you have KKR, you've got TPG, whether it's on the real estate side or on the leveraged loan side, everybody's coming to you saying, hey, I've got the best deal that I want to do, and will you finance this for us? So, for example, that's in the leveraged lending space. Now, keep in mind, it was also us saying, okay, we want to be more competitive, we want to get deals, because JPM was doing tons of these deals, B of A was doing tons of these deals, Goldman Sachs was, so we wanted to be competitive and be in there in the mix with everybody else. So it was sort of them coming to us, right, to the street. And that was part of the problem, by the way. A lot of the sponsors were really, really, really aggressive and coming to the street and beating the street up, saying, okay, well, and they sort of play one firm against the other. Well, JPM is giving us these terms. How come you won't? And that kind of was what happened. And the sponsors, and it really sort of emanated, by the way, from Europe, because the sponsors in Europe were much more aggressive. And that's where all the terms started to disappear. So I'm sure you've heard of, the MAPS disappearing and the so-called PICs and the PIC toddlers. All that stuff started out of Europe. And then, of course, if a sponsor has a deal in Europe, and now all of a sudden he comes to the States, because the banks were a lot more aggressive than investment banks, because they have more capital, right? And they don't mark to market. We do. So the banks got very aggressive. And investment banks were sort of beaten up by the sponsors, and they said, how come you can't match these terms? And the guys came from Europe and said, so take TPG as an example. They just did a deal in Europe, now they want to do a deal in the U.S., and they said, hang on, how come my European guys give me these terms and the U.S. you don't? So the bad terms sort of migrated from Europe to the U.S.
So
I don't want you to think it was sort of like, investment banks are poor, a little often sitting there and being beaten upon only. Clearly, they want to do the business, but it's also coming from the fact that the sponsors, for example, have these deals that they want to do, And so now all of a sudden we want to be aggressive and get that business, and so we want to sort of step up our risk profile because we are competing with the competitors.
So I get that for like the leverage loan business. So explain to the non-investment banker idiot lawyer how that results in Lehman having, you know, billions of dollars of additional positions in commercial and residential real estate securities.
Commercial, not residential. So, a simple example, Archdom. Archdom came, who was it? Tishman, right? And Tishman, I think it was Tishman that did that deal. And they, same concept, they wanted to do this or any, you know, Beacon Hill or any of these kind of big transactions that were being done by, you know, maybe not the KKR, well, KKR too, I guess, but any of these big transactions that are being done in their own world, on the real estate side, they come and they say, okay, we need funding. We want to buy this property. Will you fund this for us? And so in the case of Boston, it was B of A, Barclays, and Lehman Brothers. And then, of course, it got more and more aggressive, it being the guys that our clients. And they, you know, looking at what was happening in the leveraged lending space, thought, oh, you know what? In leveraged lending, they have these bridge equities. So why can't we do that in real estate? And so that sort of migrated into real estate. I don't believe there were bridge equities in real estate, you know, until more laterally. And that sort of, so it's sort of a migration of people, of clients having an interest and an inquiry to do something. Clients coming to banks and investment banks to get the funding, and then clients pitting banks and investment banks against each other to say, okay, you know, we can get these terms over here. How come you can't give us the same terms? So they kind of push, and then of course clients then seeing from one asset class that certain kinds of transactions are done, and also I'm sure investment banks and banks also saying, hey, well, we do this over there, so we can do this over here as well. You know, so for example, the bridge equity. So that's how you get inventory built up. Now the idea was, okay, we'll do this transaction, and we think we've got all these guys lined up to take that risk off of our books. The idea was never to sit there and hold this stuff. The idea was to say, okay, you know, we've got XYZ lined up, and they're going to take this piece and that. And so you kind of try to circle these things and line them up prior to, you know, any exposures. And then sort of figuring out how much exposure we'd be willing to hold until we get the rest off the books. And then, of course, when the market shuts down, you know, everybody heads for the same exit and everybody can't get through the door at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's how you end up with large balances.
All right.
Different questions. Okay. Thank you. I have some questions on risk management, which I've been trying to grapple with across a variety of institutions. Let me start by going back to a couple of things you said in terms of your role when you were talking about counterparty risk management, that it was a chief risk officer's job to figure out, do we want to do business with them or not, and how much exposure should we have. And my question is...
Well, can I just clarify one thing?
Yeah.
Chief risk officer's job to see whether or not we want to do business, yes. But I would also... deal in the context of and in collaboration with my counterparts. So, for example, legal compliance and so on. But if I had a problem with a counterpart, then I would say, you know, sorry, we're not going to do business with them. But I would also try to rely on, you know, our other, you know, risk control. Because keep in mind, risk management is not just a function, i.e., you know, my risk functions, the people that work for me, but it's a whole continuum of all of the support and control functions that work in conjunction with each other.
Okay, that's helpful. And then my question was really going to be the relationship of that cluster of activities and functions to the people that wanted to do the deal on the other side. Your traders, your people wanting to do the deal. When somebody brought you something and said, here's this great counterparty, and you said, you know, we've looked at them and we really don't think we want to do business with them, how would that conversation proceed?
That would proceed. Typically, it would be people that had worked for me would deliver the news because they're the ones that, you know, are the go-to people to begin with. And depending on the, you know, so it would either be, sorry, we're not going to deal with this guy, or, you know, we're not going to deal with this guy with this type of collateral, but if we get higher collateral and this specific collateral, collateral, by the way, is usually treasuries or cash.
Mm-hmm.
And if we, you know, the margin, if we can get this, and we have these very tight bells and whistles. So in other words, my guy would get the request. Then my guy would come to me, and I would say either yes or no. And we would do, and then if we would say, if it was a no, but, you know, clearly saying no is easy, right? But you want to say yes, but it, this is how we're going to do it. So a trader, for example, could come with one request and go home with a very different answer. Namely, yes, you can do the business, but it has to be structured in this way, and we have to have these bells and whistles, and we have to have this, you know, we have to box the risk, and we have to have the constraints all around it. So typically, that's how we would handle that. Now, there were cases where we would just say flat out, sorry, we're not dealing with this client.
And what does the trader do if they're unhappy with that conversation?
Then the trader he would go to his manager, and he would come to me, and we would have that conversation. And, you know, depending on how, you know, if it was just a risk, a credit worthiness issue, I would, you know, you can always box the risk, right?
Yeah.
There were two examples I can give you that were just non-starters for me. One was people wanting to go back into and take risk in Argentina, you know, the guys in the Buenos Aires office, after, let me try to think about the time frame, maybe 05-ish, don't hold me on that time frame.
Okay.
That was when, after, I guess, Argentina, they had defaulted in what, in 01?
Yeah.
And, of course, never made good, and still haven't made good on their defaulted money, but then they kind of got out of the woods, and they were able to sort of, you know, right the ship. And so our office in Buenos Aires, you know, they wanted to do business with you know, Argentinian counterparts again. And their view was, hey, look at this. Do business meaning taking counterparty risk. And their view was, hey, you know, things have turned around. They've got money again, so they're not broke. So what's the difference? And my answer was, well, you know, having a risk, you know, counterparty risk is not only the ability, but the willingness to pay.
Yeah.
And yes, they have the ability to pay today, but clearly they've demonstrated they have the unwillingness to not pay because they're not willing to even make good on their past debt. So the answer is no. Full stop, no. And frankly, I mean, it just never went anyplace because they took no for no.
Okay.
There was another example where because there was an interest in building up a commodity business, the business guys wanted to deal with Mark Rich. And Mark Rich, obviously being a big commodities player, the business guys thought was an important guy to have as a counterpart. And they came to me for that, and I said, no way. And they said, well, we can have all kinds of collateral, and we can have all kinds of bells and whistles, and we'll be a covered, you know, 100%. And my answer was still, no way. And my answer was, no way, because the guy's a crook. And their answer was, but he was pardoned. And my answer was, it doesn't matter, he's still a crook. And so that ended up going to the executive committee. And the trader made his case, I made my case, and that was one example where I remember it was a pretty heated, you know, disagreement. And Joe Gregory and Dick Fold sided with me and said, you know, she's right, the guy's a crook, we're not dealing with the guy.
So as a risk officer, it sounds like you were comfortable with the quality of the process by which you'd have this kind of exchange with the trading side to figure out whether you wanted to do business with somebody and on what terms. Is that fair?
That's fair, for the most part.
Well, I mean, we'll talk about later years later, but at the moment, is there at least...
That's fair. Yeah. In all honesty, there were times when, you know, we would have a conversation and it would, you know, the trader would then go to the guy that I, you know, Goldfarb, who was the person that I reported to, and try to talk Goldfarb into, you know, overruling me.
And did that happen?
Well, then Goldfarb would call me and ask me why it is that I had, you know, decided on a certain way. And for the most part, it was never that, no, we're not going to do this business, but except for the Argentinian, and except for the, as I can recall, and except for the Mark Rich. And again, this is, goes back a bit, so I don't hold me. It could have been other guys too. But for the most part, it was always, I don't like the exposure, so if we change it around, and then we can, figure out a way to do it. Because keep in mind, you have to be commercial, and obviously, you have to take risks because we're in the risk business, right? And at the end of the day, as I said earlier, it's the idea is to balance how much risk you take, which, with maximizing your returns.
So if we talk up to the period of 2005, a really skilled former risk officer once told me that if push comes to shove, you got to be ready to walk the plank. Did you ever... I didn't hear that, sorry.
I was trying to find what walk the plank means in this context.
Okay. That was this person's expression, not mine. My question is, were you ever overruled to the extent where, and we're talking 2005 and earlier, where you really thought, I may not be able to keep on going and keep my position here?
No.
Okay, great. Let me go to another question, if I may. You talked about stress tests using historical data back to the late 80s. And you thought it was a pretty rigorous approach. We've talked to enough people now.
No, don't. That's a misquote of what I said.
Okay.
That was just in one example for one type of narrowly defined asset class and one type of narrowly defined test. We did all kinds of analytics and all kinds of jump to default and all kinds of stresses, which were, different from that. That was just one thing we were talking about.
Okay. And that sets the stage for my question. We have heard a lot of people in a lot of different kinds of institutions say, well, nobody could predict that housing prices were going to drop, and for sure not the way they dropped. As a risk officer who was going through this kind of procedure before, again, 2005, what's your answer to that?
Well, my answer is, for mortgages, as a former mortgage trader, part of the analytics for the residential mortgage was as housing values went down. And so one of the many analytics for the mortgage business that we would perform on a daily basis was all kinds of stresses, which included housing prices fell and defaults rose. And then we would run those analytics through what we call a waterfall, because obviously if it's a structured, a CMO, for example, you have, different parts of that securitization would survive versus the others, right? Because the cash flows would be directed towards one tranche versus the other. So we would do that on a daily basis. What I would say is, so that's what we did. No one would have predicted the magnitude of that fall. And in particular, I think what people have lost sight is, not that I can recall, there has never been a housing price decline, and certainly in that magnitude, without an economic event first. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because this time around we've had an economic event, and then, the housing prices fall, and that caused an economic event. If you think about the last housing prices, bust that we've had, it's been things like in Texas, but that was because of the economy first, right?
Yeah.
The oil industry. It was in California, but that was because of the aerospace industry first.
Yeah.
So if you think about all the big housing crises that we've had, it's always been economic cause, and then the effect has been housing. We've never had housing crater and then an economic recession. So I think it's true that people would not have expected housing to be that dramatically impacted.
So
it's true that we had our stresses, and we did include property value losses. And same with real estate. The property value losses that we used for real estate, that was what I was referring to, where we used the 90, 89, 90, 91, 92 real estate recession for our commercial real estate, but for the property value losses for our residential, we did other things. So we did assume property value losses in all analytics, but clearly not. Certainly, real estate, by the way, I still don't think that we've hit the lows, or I think I've read recently that we've just recently touched, equaled, not surpassed, the lows of the 1990-91 time frame. So my analytics were correct in terms of how much we assumed. Clearly, on the residential side, the property value losses were more than our analytics allowed for.
Now, could you describe your stress tests? I mean, people have talked to me about Monte Carlo simulations, and there your tail events have such low probabilities that they tend not to affect the results very much. How would you deal with the tail risk implicit in this kind of stress test?
And, you know, those Monte Carlo simulations, too, have to assume some kind of distribution, and most of those distributions are probably normality, and which is not an appropriate approach anyway.
That was your perception also before 2005?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I don't like any kind of so-called stress test that's assuming a distribution. The way we would do stress is, for example, which we set this framework up in, you know, when I first joined. That was, if you remember, my first assignment. One of the things that we would do, let me take high yields as an example. What we would do is we would talk, and now if you hear, you know, about Basel II, they started to include what they call jump to default. We had that in place in 1999, 2000. Every asset class that we had, we would look at what kind of risk could make this thing blow up. So you have the market risk, the credit risk, but then you also have what I call event risk. And the event risk is unique to each asset class. So for high yield, for example, we would look at the default, and it's the probability of default of every one of the assets that we had, loans or bonds. And then, you know, what's the probability of default? And it would be based on the sector, it would be based on the industry, it would be based on the where in the capital structure this thing was. And then, of course, the recovery rate would be based on those things. But we would look at, you know, what's the default, what's the probability of default, how much we could lose, what would be our recovery rate. And so we would analyze each one of those aspects and not use an assumed model, i.e. distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, you know, by definition, you've already introduced some, you know, error into your results.
Great. I'd like to go to the Veloukis report, if I might. And I take it from the way you've cited it that, you know, without binding you to every word, you're relatively comfortable with what it says, particularly about you and about risk management.
I haven't read every word, obviously, but to the extent of what I did read, I think it was relatively accurate. The only thing I was not comfortable with, and I think it's not correct, but it's unfortunate because, no offense to any lawyers in the room, but, you know, here's lawyers, and they've done a great job, don't get me wrong, but they also don't understand totally the business, and they also, I think, unfortunately, perhaps ask maybe some of the wrong people some of the wrong questions, and so their comments about stress tests and not being done or whatever, I forget now exactly, were, I think, you know, kind of a little bit off the mark and not correct.
Okay, I'm going to go through some of that, and then we can sort of have a little conversation as we go. What I'd like to start with is what struck me most about their conclusions given the final outcome in 2008. Quote, Lehman had sophisticated policies, procedures, and metrics in place to estimate the risk that the firm could assume without jeopardizing its ability to achieve a target rate of return and to apprise management and the board whether Lehman was within various risk limits. I take it that's what you've been describing here, and in retrospect, at least through 2005 or 6, you'd agree with that sentence.
Correct.
Can you describe how, for example, you would address liquidity risk in the way you were approaching your policies, procedures, and so on?
Liquidity risk was not part of a risk management's mandate.
Okay. That was in the treasurer again?
Correct.
But I assume they had some liquidity risk management parameters, right?
I would hope so, but you need to ask the Treasury guys, because I was not involved.
All right, we'll do that. Thank you. The next part was the issue of stress tests that we'll get to. And then the third sentence, I don't know if you have it there, in which case I can give you page numbers.
Save
you.
I don't.
No, we don't.
Okay. Lehman had an extensive staff that was devoted solely to risk management. What was the size of your risk management staff?
I want to say towards the end, plus or minus, including my technology support, 450.
450 people. And then you mentioned the other support units that you had. How many of those would also have been dedicated to risk in a sense?
No one else was, quote, dedicated to risk, but other, we work in conjunction. So, for example, very importantly, our partners in the finance, the product control guys, right? So those guys would do the daily P&Ls.
Yeah.
And they would, and then we would look at, you know, what was the P&L versus what we call backtesting. What was the P&L versus what we predicted the risk? So risk is saying we can lose X on a daily basis. The P&L is your empirical observation every day, and so you do the backtesting, saying, okay, we thought X and it turned out to be Y, or and so, you know, how did that risk How did that risk measure fare vis-a-vis reality?
Right? And then that would be feedback to you for your forthcoming assessments of risk.
That would be feedback to us for back testing of any of our models.
Okay.
I wouldn't say forthcoming assessment. I would say going and just checking how did you know the model perform. But it's also a good test for the P&L guy, for us to say, hang on, that P&L says X, no way. You know, our risk says why, you got to go check your P&L because something might be wrong with your P&L. So it's not as if we would take that as gospel, because there could be a problem there, right? So there was work and, you know, interaction across the different functions. And then, of course, you know, you had the audit function, the compliance function, so everybody's worked together in terms of almost a continuum, if you will, in terms of how we thought about risk.
A number of firms also use the concept of embedded risk officers, which means that you have risk officers located within the business units. Did Lehman have that?
Do you mean risk officers that are part of the business unit as opposed to working for me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that the business units had their own guys that would be, they would not be called a quote risk officer. They have guys that are their risk guy, yes, and we had that too. But what I would also have is very importantly, which other firms did not do, is the kind of people that I would hire are the kind of people that either have, you know, highly quantitative and or training or business background, and people that, so we did not look at, or I did not look at risk as just a measurement and reporting function, because that's just the rearview mirror to risk management. What you want to do is be proactive, work with the business before transactions happen, so that you can try to mitigate risk. So what I would hire, people that had the credibility of the, and the business people would want to get their advice. And what I would do was have my risk people, my risk officers, embedded, to use your word, on the trading desk. So, for example, my guy for the credit products sat with the head of the credit product trading business. And there's no substitute for hearing and seeing what's going on instantaneously.
Yep.
To be able to manage risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
To A, manage risk and give feedback to me, and B, be there as a source, a resource to the business. And so my guys were embedded on the various desks, so whether it was, you know, specific to residential trading or the treasuries or some derivatives, I had equities, I had guys, various of my market risk guys sat on all the different trading desks. And that's true, by the way, for the most part, globally.
Globally meaning?
I had people that worked for me in America, in New York, in Europe, right, and in Asia.
Okay.
So in Asia, there was Tokyo, we had people in Korea, we had people in Hong Kong. You know, I can't even remember his list. I had somebody down in Miami. We had people all over the place.
Would the role difference between your risk person sitting on the trading desk and the traders lead to conflict, friction?
My risk person and the traders, or the traders' risk person?
The person you describe working for you that would be sitting with the traders, watching what they were doing as they were doing it.
Yes. Would there be conflict between him and whom?
The trader that was doing it.
No. There shouldn't be conflict, but there shouldn't be too coziness either, right? It has to be an intellectually independent, intellectually honest person who's mature enough to not become, you know, drink the Kool-Aid, as they say, and become part of the trading desk. So he knows where he's getting paid. He's getting paid from me. And the whole concept of his job is to advise and help, you know, steer the business out of trouble, but at the same time, you know, do the risk reporting, the analytics, and ensure that, you know, the business doesn't blow up.
Okay, so you're fairly comfortable with the way that you were able to manage that, and you did it, if I hear you right, largely by picking seasoned people, good people, that could both understand what was going on and could at the same time keep their independence. Is that okay?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because think about it. If you have a guy who is not credible, the business, and is not savvy enough, the business can just run circles around the risk guy, right? And if you have a function that's just a sort of a so-called risk reporting function where the guy sits, you know, on a different floor, that's not quite effective because all he's doing is cranking out numbers all day long, which is looking at what yesterday's business was as opposed to who's getting in trouble today. So what you need is somebody that's really proactive, working alongside the business, that's sort of keeping an eye and ear. And also, you know, there's no substitute. Having been a trader and having sat on a trading desk, you realize, which you may not be able to appreciate because you haven't, you know, had that experience, you realize how there is absolutely no substitute to being in, you know, in the mix and among the flow, because, you know, just hearing activity all of a sudden. So if you're a guy that's just running reports in a different floor, you won't even know, was it busier or slow today, and, you know, and in what sector, and therefore you won't even know what to look for. But now you're on the trading desk and you hear all of a sudden down the aisle, you know, there's a lot of activity. So you're going to ensure, by the way, when you're looking at your reports, just as a simple of example, you know, did I see some activity picking up in that sector? If not, well, maybe we're missing some trades because I know those guys are doing a lot of business today because I saw them sitting there, you know, going crazy. So there's a lot to be gained, not only from, you know, sort of sitting there and helping advise or, you know, kind of keeping an eye on, but there's just a lot to be gained even to ensure that your information is complete by being in the middle of the flow, seeing what's going on.
So of your 450 people, what number were in the middle of the flow, as you said?
Oh, it was just a market risk side. So the 450 would include a good number, and I don't know off the top of my head, the technology people that were supporting my function. It would also include all of the different risk disciplines. So that was market risk, and the market risk guys are the guys that were embedded on the trading floor, because that's the mark-to-market stuff, right?
Uh-huh.
But there's also counterparty credit risk. There's also the credit guys, who were the guys that would look at these deals. There was operational risk, there was sovereign risk, the quantitative risk group, you know, the model validation guys. So, I mean, there's like a, I'm sure I'm forgetting, there was the collateralized lending group. So I can't tell you off the top of my head how many. I would say maybe, let me think, 50?
Wow, okay. Now, they talk about, I'm going to the Veloukis report now, and thank you, this has been really helpful. Lehman had a dramatically smaller equity base than its commercial banking competitors, and you alluded to that, and a somewhat smaller equity base than its investment banking competitors. So Lehman had a lower single transaction limit than its competitors, which, as you had pointed out, forced it to forego or limit participation in a number of big deals. And then basically Lehman decided to expand its single credit limit, and it says here that you thought that the firm should abide by the single credit limit but you and Kirk were overruled by Fuld, Gregory, and McGee.
A single transaction limit, that's correct.
And when was that?
What page are you reading this? I'm going to go home and look at that. I didn't see that.
All right. Pages
but it is correct.
75 and 76. Actually, it started at 74 to 76.
I want to say that started...
74 and 76 of what volume?
I'm sorry. This is volume section 3A1, risk.
Volume just goes very close. Oh, this is risk.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What volume again?
3A1, risk. Okay, so I want to say that started in...
It says late 2006. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, late 2006, and then certainly, you know, yeah, for sure.
Can you describe the conversation or the way, the process by which this happened? Was this, let me ask the larger question, was this part of a strategic shift that started to take place, or was this sort of the first time something like this had come up and you were asked about the single transaction limit and you had a different view than your boss?
I wouldn't say that I was asked and had a different view. I would say that this is part of the strategic, remember I indicated in March of 06 that was a, we're going to, you know, sort of ramp up business.
Yep.
And I would say that I was not part of a conversation with McGee and Fuld. But it was more of a, you know, they, management, executive committee, among themselves saying, look, McGee, I'm just speculating now, McGee saying, you want me to do, you know, bring in more dollars on the investment banking side, I can't be constrained by these limits. And this is part of what I was telling you earlier, where the KKRs of the world were coming, and it, were coming with bigger and bigger and crazier sized deals. Take TXU, for example, in February of 07, I want to say that was, where, you know, so the pressure from the street was enormous in terms of the deals. And so, you know, just envision McGee, who was running banking, trying to compete with, you know, the JPMs of the world, who were doing these large deals because they had more balance sheet. And you should keep in mind, part of the problem is inconsistent regulation. Mark-to-market is what we do in investment banks, we did, and banks don't. So a bank, and Goldman made a point of this, by the way, in one transaction by immediately marking it down a lot, and you may remember that in the press. You know, so a bank can do a deal, and they can tuck it into their held-to-maturity account, which is what they do.
Yep.
And Goldman or Lehman does a deal, and we mark it to reality, right? Mark to market. And so you can only do so many deals and mark it down immediately when and compete with the bank who is just putting it into the held-to-maturity account and not marking it down. And therefore, they were doing aggressive lending, you know, off-market lending is basically what that is, right?
Okay. Let me go back to the strategic shift. We had talked at the commission. We received a document concerning one company that basically said, we've got a strategic choice. Either we stick to our traditional credit standards, this was a credit issue, or we meet the market and we start participating actively and really go with it. Is that essentially the kind of strategic decision that Lehman was making in March of 06?
That was, I would say, the outcome of the strategic decision. The strategic decision is we need to increase our, we need to continue to maximize the use of our capital. That means take more risk. Well, how do you take more risk? We take more risk by doing exactly what you just said. So that's sort of the effect, not the cause, if you know what I mean.
Is there a strategic planning document you can refer us to that would essentially give that set of choices or that decision?
I would not have any such a thing.
Okay,
no.
Well, there are a few footnotes in the Veloukis report, so we may be able to find
yeah.
that.
Yeah, you know, there was this, you may, I'm sure, look in the Veloukis report, on, you know, you know how to do it online, right? You
yep.
just type in a word. Look under Turnberry, and that's where the conference was in Turnberry.
Turnberry,
you know that golf course down in Florida?
Okay, great. Thank you.
And then I'm sure there were plenty of documents because there were presentations. It was a real conference where we sat there and, you know, there were presentations that were made and about this is the kind of risk that we want to take and this is the profile.
So the company decided we're going to take more risk. You had mentioned Archstone. And again, this seems to be an issue where you...
No, I mentioned Archstone as an example because you said, okay, well, that was one of your colleagues said those are examples of private, the leveraged lending business, and real estate's different. And I said, no, actually, real estate's not so different. It's also the case. It's not us shopping around looking to say, okay, let's go buy this or buy that. It's mostly them coming to us saying, can you finance this for us? And, to, and you, know, you very eloquently just stated the problem, where the sponsors or the clients, our clients, our being investment banking industry's clients, were coming and demanding, first requesting, and then of course when they request financing or funding for a particular kind of transaction, and then they try to pit one guy against the other. Which, by the way, is just an aside, and this is sort of my personal view, which you should really kind of, in the context of everything you're doing, you should think about, is, you know, there's so many guys that try to point the finger at, you know, who is the cause of all this. And people, for example, in the hedge fund space or in the private equity space, say, hey, we were the good guys. We didn't do anything. And somehow, some way, it all gets forgotten about, well, who were the guys that were really driving the demand, right? And supply was created because of demand in the residential real estate space, for example. And of course, that's because of so much liquidity in the system because of, you know, lax monetary policy, in my view. But you had the private equity guys, you had the hedge fund guys being extremely aggressive, pushing, you know, banks and investment banks. And yet they step back and say, hey, see that? We were not regulated, and therefore, it's bad to make regulation because, by definition, we didn't do anything and we didn't blow up. Well, the truth is, they're the ones that pushed everybody over the edge.
Do you know any companies...
And by the way, it was the inconsistent regulation, excuse me, that was one of the fundamental problems. As I gave you an example just now, banks, investment banks, doing the same kind of business, one has a mark-to-market because of their regime, one doesn't. And I can name plenty of examples where you have institutions, hedge funds, banks, investment banks, insurance companies, all doing the same business, yet because the regulation wasn't for a particular activity, but it was based on how you were incorporated or chartered. And that makes no sense because that was a so-called regulatory arbitrage.
We're going to be looking at regulatory arbitrage, I assure you. Let me ask this. Do you know of any significant firms on the street that basically said, we're not going to play under those rules because we believe what our models and risk managers are telling us?
No.
So everybody was playing.
Correct. You remember poor Chuck Prince's comment.
Yeah.
That's what he was talking about.
All right, Archstone. I want to go back to Archstone for a second. On page 112 of this part of the Veloukis report, it says, notwithstanding Archstone's consideration by senior management of the firm, Lehman's risk managers said they had minimal input in the decision to acquire Archstone.
Correct.
That sounds different from, gee, we've changed strategy and we're going to change our risk parameters. It almost sounds like, hey, full speed ahead, and we don't need to listen to these guys anymore. Am I misinterpreting that?
No, because that's what it was, sort of an evolution. We're going to change strategy, and now we're going to change strategy, and, you know, risk guys, you know, we're all on the same page here, and then it kind of evolved into we're changing the strategy, and sort of, you know, we got pedal to the metal, as they would say, and, you know, doesn't matter.
And there was
that was fundamentally at the end what happened, that risk was overruled. And that's what the Veloukis report shows.
And that Archstone was in mid-07?
Correct.
Huh? Were you involved at that point, or was that the point of your transition to your policy position?
That was the point of my transition. My transition was a long one, the way things worked at Lehman Brothers. So it was sort of an unofficial, I was sort of sidelined, sort of unofficially, but in a very, you know, in a way that made it a little bit clearer, because that's how things worked over there, you know, early part of 07. February of 07, April, you know, that time frame, February.
So
Archstone was probably in, but I was still officially the head of risk, but the Archstone transaction, I was not involved in.
Ah, okay.
And frankly, the reason that I wasn't involved in Archstone is because the guy that ran the commitments committee, Stephen Brokenfeld, when he set up the meeting for that, I remember him saying that you know, the executive committee has already approved it. And that was not the process. So the process sort of fell apart. And I said, well, then what's the point of us doing this? I'm not even going to go to the meeting. You know, that's ridiculous. So what happened was, you know, risk ended up getting overruled, but also sort of at that point in time, the process that we had put in place, which was a very robust process, basically started to fall apart.
Wow. In this whole, I'm done with my questions, except are there gaps in what we've asked you so far about the risk management process from when you first arrived to this point, mid-07, that any aspects of it that we should understand a little more of the nuances of?
No, but what I would say is when I first arrived, there was no risk management to speak of. So it went from a, you know, nothing really going on with a risk management perspective to, and I think it was the 98 experience that was the wake-up call. And the reality is if Lehman should have gone under, it probably should have gone under 98 because they didn't have any framework. They didn't have a liquidity framework. And so I think that was the wake-up call. And so we ended up, you know, they hired me and they established a liquidity framework, which they hadn't had before. And it went from nothing to a very robust framework. In fact, Lucas, not only in his report, but at the hearing, which I watched the whole thing, you know, the Barney Frank hearing, he said that as far as he could tell, everything he heard and from either the rating agencies, regulators, anybody that spoke with him, his staff, as well as everything he saw, he said that risk was, and the analytics and everything was robust, comprehensive, and complete. And that's true. And it was also, you know, sort of became a natural thing, if you will, where the business guys, you know, not only quote bought into it, but they felt the way I sort of evolved risk was not only to have them buy into it because you want them to really be part of it, right? And so I had them almost thinking it was their idea, and that way, you know, when you have people, when you sort of set up a framework such that people feel part of the whole process, then they're gonna want to comply by it. And so we got to a point of where everybody was sort of on the same page, certainly at the business level, but at that senior levels, then they were trying to push so hard that the, you know, the wheels started to come off.
But I guess I'm sort of surprised, let me put it this way, that the gap between 1998 long-term capital management and what happened to Lehman then when they got religion and July of 07, that's not an awful long time to lose religion.
That's correct.
What happened?
I guess success and making money, you know, streetwise. People just started, you know, what happens is people, euphoria. People start saying, okay, come on, you know, sky's going to continue to grow to the limit.
Is there any more color you can provide us on your the mid-07 transition from being the chief risk officer to being the policy relations person? You know, just sort of the obvious stuff. Was that a transfer that you did not ask for and that was thrust upon you, or was it something that you wanted? I mean, give it the context of it. Was it just part of the story of the wheels coming off and the evolution of Lehman not giving a damn about what the risk folks were saying?
Well, I wouldn't use the word not giving a damn.
Fair enough.
But yes, that was thrust upon me. It was not, the policy was not thrust upon me, but getting out of risk was thrust upon me. And very specifically, it was conversations with Joe Gregory. Having said that, you know, he wanted me to move out of risk, he said, you know, we love you, you're brilliant, we don't want you to leave the firm, and, you know, you do a great job, you know, engaging with the outside, you know, whether it's regulators, rating agencies, buy-side sell-side analysts, and so on, so why don't you figure out what else you can do and help us make money? And so, at that point, they indicated that, you know, Goldman does a great job having, oh, by the way, they do a great job in the policy space, and they can help influence the outcome of policy, so why don't you figure out how to do that? And so that's what I did.
Who took your place?
Chris O'Mara, former CFO.
Was Alex Kirk transitioned during this time as well?
I can't remember because there were so many people coming and going. Alex was still... I don't remember when Alex left. And then he came back. That's true? Yeah. Alex left? Can't tell you. I don't remember. Oh, I know. It was in January or February of 08. They brought in a rival to head up fixed income, and that's when Alex left. Andy Morton. So whenever Andy Morton showed up on the scene, you can look up your facts, is when Alex left. And then Alex came back, I want to say June-ish of 08.
Right. Did other folks leave? You mentioned earlier that the risk function was about 450 people. Did that number decline in this time frame or in any time frame?
I have no idea. I was out.
When you left, or when you transitioned to the policy position in the summer of 07, did other people leave the risk management function too?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Not that I know.
Did you have any discussions with your direct reports about what was going on?
No, that's not the way I am.
Okay.
I just moved on. In fact, I had no comments and conversations with anybody. And it wasn't until July of 08, there was an article on Bloomberg, which frankly surprised me to see that. And actually, I was quite upset by that because I thought, oh my God, I don't want people to think that I said anything, because I was, you know, worried that Joe and Dave would be, you know, concerned that I spoke out, and that's because that's not how I am.
Okay.
So how that ever even, I guess people figure things out sooner or later.
Right. Ms. Antonchik, if I pronounced that correctly. Thank you very much for your time. I'm sure, as I tell everybody this, we'll go back over our notes, talk amongst ourselves. We may have some follow-up questions. If so, we'll contact your counsel. But otherwise, thank you very much for your time and talking to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.